Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Guidelines for various screenings for cancer have been published in the last several years, and today we're going to be talking about the screening guidelines for lung cancer. Which patients is it appropriate for? Who is it most effective to do? And who should be screened? And how accurate is this screening? Today, helping me address these issues in the studio is Kathleen Roderick. She is undergone some screening here at Providence Hospital. And Roy Alpin. Roy is the director of the Providence Cancer Center. Joining me by telephone is Jamie Blom. Jamie is the radiation oncologist with the Cancer Center. Roy and Dr. Blom were with us in February to talk about this program. They now have 4 months of information and data, and we think it's time to kind of discuss all that again and also get the feedback from someone who's been in the middle of it and done some of the screening to see how she thinks about it. And that's the reason Kathleen is joining us. So welcome to all of you. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you.
To remind everybody who's listening, if you've got questions or comments about lung cancer screening or lung cancer, none of us are specifically oncologists treating cancer specifically other than Dr. Blom, who does the radiation treatment of lung cancer. So we may not be able to answer everybody's lung cancer questions, but we certainly can talk about the screening, the technology, the personal experiences of someone who's gone through that. And that's what we want to address today. And if you've got questions or comments, here's how you get a hold of us during the next hour. 550-8433. 550-8433. That's our local number. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as usual, you can email us at line1, and you have to spell that out, all one word, LINEONE, at alaskapublic.org. Dr. Blom, we're going to start with you. I think I would like to go through a little bit of the basics of what lung cancer is, what cancer is, and so we have some fundamental understanding before we start talking about the appropriateness of lung cancer screening and what we know about it. So tell us a little bit about lung cancer to start with.
Okay. Well, lung cancer, like other cancers or cancer in general, is an aberration of our metabolism, so to speak. So in other words, in our bodies, our cells are constantly dividing and dying, and new ones replacing them, etc. And that's a very regulated process. And in cancer, we wind up having certain genes that get turned on or get turned off that disrupt the regulation. And so you have unregulated growth of what are otherwise normal tissues. And so this unregulated growth is what basically causes a cancer.
And lung cancer is a cancer that originates in the lung, but it may not all be the same thing. We think of cancer as a one thing, but it's actually different cancers can originate in the lung and they can act differently, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, there are different histologies or different types of lung cancer. You have, it used to be we called everything either small cell lung cancer or non-small cell lung cancer. And now we've gotten much more sophisticated to be able to break down the non-small cell lung cancer cohort into different little categories that have different treatment implications. So the non-small cell lung cancers are about 85% of all the lung cancers. Small cell are about 15%. Of the non-small cell lung cancers, you have different types: adenocarcinomas, squamous cell carcinomas, large cell carcinomas, bronchoalveolar carcinomas.
And the reason for recognizing the differences is not just a semantic issue. These, as you've already implied, may act differently, may respond to treatment differently, may not respond to one treatment like another one. So knowing specifically what each kind of cancer is has very important implications for patients.
You bet. Small cell lung cancer, even if it's found very early, is not a surgical disease. That's small cell lung cancer is one that's treated with a combination of chemotherapy and radiation therapy together. and there's no surgery involved. Non-small cell lung cancers, on the other hand, are primarily surgically treated if we find them early enough. Okay, so, and that's pretty much the whole goal behind screening. So these patients have options for either definitive surgical excision for cure, or there are some radiation techniques now that are demonstrating equivalent efficacy to surgery in selected patients called stereotactic body radiotherapy. Mm-hmm. So the primary modality is different, and then also in patients who have more advanced disease, that whole field has burgeoned for medical oncology in terms of having special chemotherapy or immunotherapeutic agents for different types of those non-small cell lung cancers.
So just to rehash again and to move towards my next question is that we now think of cancers as the result of some dysregulation of our normal process of renewing cells. We constantly, our cells are dying, and our genetics are our DNA and RNA and all these repair mechanisms are constantly fixing these things. And occasionally, either because of genetic reasons, we don't have the right repair mechanisms in our own genetics, or because something causes more abnormalities, we end up with some cancer. And so most cancers increase with time, but not all. So I guess if I'm saying that correctly and it makes sense, the next question is, what are the risk factors for lung cancer? What are the things that increase the likelihood we're going to have
one? Sure. Well, of course, the biggest one is smoking. You know, the biggest three are smoking, and smoking. Everything else sort of pales in comparison. And so smoking, there are very clear data that show actually that particularly in women, the rise of lung cancer has paralleled the rise of smoking from the 60s. So in the Virginia Slims, you've come a long way, baby, advertisements of the 60s. Well, it has really caused the women's rate of lung cancer to go up precipitously, while during the same time men were starting to try to cut back on their smoking, and the men's lung cancer rates have come down.
Mm-hmm. There are, well, maybe it's reasonable to say, I think the American Cancer Society and the Lung Association would like us to say, that it's not only lung cancer, there are other particular problems clearly associated with smoking, including other cancers like bladder cancer, where my own father died of a bladder cancer, which was his biggest and major risk factor was cigarette smoking. And then smoking can cause other problems such as emphysema and other lung disorders as well. So it is important to recognize, and there's pretty good evidence we're making some success now in having more and more people stop smoking. And I saw, I think just recently, a study that shows the younger individuals are beginning to decrease the amount of smoking that they're starting to get into as well.
Yeah, you know, we worry a lot about cholesterol and weight loss and those sorts of things, and those are all important, but the single most important thing someone could do for their health is to quit smoking, without question.
I think I've got a statistic here somewhere that in the United States, tobacco use is responsible for nearly 1 in 5 deaths. So it's clearly a very, very significant factor. And if we wanted to nationwide to do something more about unnecessary deaths, addressing tobacco use is important. And I guess that's why we're spending so much time and effort in on that particular problem. So yeah. I've got a listing of other triggers that are associated with the risk for lung cancer, including asbestos, which many of us have heard about. Many chemicals have been associated with it, certainly a family history, air pollution, radiation therapy, which we're going to talk about a little bit, is a risk to the screening, and then radon gas. Anybody here want to make any comments about those issues or any?
Yeah, I mean, those are without question, potential contributors. Their significance, though, is much, much less than the smoking. So, in other words, I don't want somebody who, lives at home with a spouse that smokes and they don't, thinking that they have the same risk as somebody who is smoking themselves. Same thing, I mean, diesel fumes. I mean, geez, folks have to go out and fish and work on boats. That's not the same magnitude of risk, but those are certainly associated.
And before we came on the air, we wanted to address a quote or a perhaps fact that seems to be out there that may not be interpreted correctly, and that's that 80% of new lung cancer cases are diagnosed in patients who've never smoked or were former smokers who quit decades ago. Do you want to address that comment?
Yeah, you know, it's actually a reasonably accurate statistic, but it's the interpretation that's the problem. Of lung cancer diagnoses, only about 15% occur in never smokers. Okay, so the huge balance of that statistic are people who are former smokers. Okay, so when you hear a statistic that says 80% of folks with lung cancer were never smokers or former smokers, it may lead you to kind of downplay the significance of smoking, and that's not really true. I think that there should be two statistics there. 15% of lung cancers occur in people who never smoked. And that's just flat-out bad luck or whatever other genetic issues they had. But then you've got probably, you know, 50-60% of the people who get lung cancers were smokers.
All right. Let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our guests today are Kathleen Roderick. She is a patient who's undergone some screening for lung cancer in the Providence Cancer Center. Roy Olpin, who's the director of the Providence Cancer Center. And we've been listening to and talking with James Blum, who is the radiation oncologist. We're talking about screening for lung cancer. And to get into that, I just wanted to discuss lung cancer in some broader depth. If you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So let's now talk about screening. What are the important issues about screening, and how is it now that we've come to the point where we think we can offer screening appropriately to patients?
Well, let's talk about the size of the problem first. I think this year there's somewhere in the order of 230,000 new diagnoses of lung cancer. And of that, there are about 160,000 deaths. There has not been a significant improvement in the cure rate for all lung cancers in the past, 15 years or so. For all comers, for all patients, the survival rate is small. The cure rate is about 15%, and that's because the vast majority of these patients are diagnosed at a more advanced stage. Okay. In comparison, people who have cancers found at screening, they have upwards of a 90% cure rate. So you're taking a disease process for whom there's a large body at risk, for whom you can define who is most likely to get the cancer. So we know that smokers are the biggest risk group. Okay, so you and I mentioned had spoken before we came on the air how lung cancer screening actually has an advantage over, say, mammography or colonoscopies or pap smears, because you can identify the people at greater risk by their history, their smoking history, their age, et cetera. So
It makes sense to screen. We have a population. What I'm hearing you say is that's definitely be able to be identified, and we also know that in those people who get screened, we're catching the disease earlier, and that seems to lead to a much better survival rate.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
That's what you were saying, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And we want to get. It seems to be a slam dunk when you hear that, but there's another side of the coin, and that's the
overdiagnosis and complications. So it gets a little bit more complicated. So let's back up. And now there's been a couple of screening trials that perhaps we should just discuss that gives us the solid information we need to
sure.
decide who should be screened and why.
You know, historically, there have been studies looking at chest X-ray mm-hmm. versus observation. And not surprisingly, those didn't show any advantage to screening. You know, a chest X-ray only can see maybe about 40%, or it misses about 40% of the lung because of the heart, et cetera, that's living in the middle there. It doesn't have anywhere near the resolution of a CAT scan. So there was a nationwide trial called the NLST, National Lung Cancer Screening Trial, that randomized patients. It took 53,000 patients, and they were randomized between a low-dose CT scan once a year for 3 years and chest X-rays once a year for 3 years. What they found with that study was that there was an actual survival advantage. There's a 20% survival advantage in the group that had CT scan over chest X-ray. Okay, that's not CT scan versus nothing, which would show you an even greater advantage. That was CT scan over chest X-ray, and those results have been so profound that the American Cancer Society, the American Lung Association, American Society of Thoracic Oncology have all come out and endorsed lung cancer screening for appropriate patient populations.
What were the criteria that came out of this that were felt to be useful and helpful for deciding who should be screened?
Sure. So they defined two basic risk groups. The first group are people aged 55 to 74 who have what we call a 30-pack year smoking history. So a pack year is, say, one pack a day for a year, or so if you smoked one pack a day for 30 years, that's one pack year. If you smoked two packs a day for 15 years, that's 30 pack years. Okay, mm-hmm. So age 55 to 74, 30 pack year smoking history, and either active smokers or if they quit smoking, had to be within the past 15 years. Okay, there was a second group of men, or men and women, that were over the age of 50. And had a 20-pack year smoking history, but then they had one additional risk factor. And these are the risk factors that you had mentioned before, sort of radar exposure, occupational exposure, other tobacco-associated cancer history, family history of lung cancer, COPD. Now, interestingly, secondhand smoke is not a significant enough risk factor to make it into that. That cohort.
Okay. Let's go ahead and take a phone call which addresses this issue, I think, of the secondhand smoke exposure. Christian, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, my sister has lung cancer. She was initially diagnosed with asthma and bronchitis, and unfortunately the cancer progressed until it was finally discovered. She is about a dozen years older than myself, lived with my dad, who was a two-pack-a-day smoker for, 18 years or so until she left the house. And I'm wondering, you just mentioned the secondhand smoke, but I'm wondering if, you know, back in the day of long car rides with a smoker, if that could be one of the causes, because she has never been a smoker.
Yeah, obviously it would be better to not be exposed to secondhand smoke as opposed to be exposed to it continuously, but those data are not so clear on the effect of secondhand smoke, and it may be because there are so many confounding variables in that. Could it be the secondhand smoke that contributed? It sure could, but you can't say definitively.
Does it make a difference, Dr. Blum, if you know, we said already that there are different kinds of cancer. So you can think of these as different kinds of people, so to speak. They have different
you know, different hair color, different size, different weight, different ages. Is smoking associated more or less with each of the different cancers the same, or is there some difference, or are you unaware of that?
Well, you know, I mean, small cell lung cancer is almost exclusively associated with smoking. There are some, and we talked about the people who do not have any smoking history, they get lung cancers. In particular, there's a cohort of typically younger women and, for some reason, typically younger Asian women who are non-smokers who develop an adenocarcinoma, which is a particular, you know, particular type of a non-small cell lung cancer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about the caller's Christian's question about his sister that developed lung cancer. And I'd had an epidemiologist from, I want to say, Columbia University on a couple of years ago. And he is very, very critical, as some of these epidemiologists are, of really looking at the information. And he raised the question that I think you're raising, is that it's not as clear as people would think about the risk for secondhand smoke. And it's because, not that it may not be, but it's just very, very difficult to document that because of so many other possibilities. How long were they in there? How much did they smoke? How long were you in the house with the family that smoked? Both of my parents died of smoking-related illnesses. They both had much more than 30-pack years. And I have myself and two brothers. I'm 65, another one's 60, another one 50. We've never had any smoking relating disorders at all. So these are difficult questions.
While you were speaking, I just pulled up on the web system in my office right here the NCCN guidelines for lung cancer screening. And the comment they make about secondhand smoke is as follows. They say, individuals exposed to secondhand smoke have a highly variable exposure to the carcinogens, with varying evidence for increased risk after this variable exposure. Therefore, secondhand smoke is not independently considered a risk factor for lung cancer screening.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I know, as I recall during that program, some of the nonprofits involved with cancer and smoking were not happy with it, but I think the important thing is to be as honest as we can about what we know and what we don't know at any particular time about this. And that information is dynamic and constantly changing as well. So Providence Hospital, Roy, let me just bring you in here, and we've got a program going in Anchorage now, in the state. I'm sure you're the only program. Tell us a little bit about what initiated this and how you guys have gone about starting it.
Absolutely, Dr. Woodard. Thank you again for having us on today. So we at Providence Alaska Medical Center and the Providence Cancer Center have had a program in place for lung screening since February 26th of this year. So we've got about 4+ months of time to be able to potentially enroll patients in the screening. Most cancer programs, if they don't already have a lung screening program in place, they're thinking about implementing one. So I can give you just a little bit of data behind how our program has gone thus far. We have actually had, through the Providence Call Center, 81 inquiries from the community for people who were seeking the possibility of being screened. Of those, half of them were eligible for the screening. And of the half that were eligible, we ended up actually screening 12 patients out of about 40, so about a third. So there have been 12 patients screened so far with the low-dose CT methodology. One of the things that we were able to do to get the word out to our community served is we did a mass mailing with our card to 40,000 individuals and households in the Anchorage area. That's how Kathleen knew about our program, who's with us today, and we appreciate Kathleen being here. And basically, this card just gives you a synopsis of the criteria by which you may be eligible for screening via this program. And it has a specific phone line that's linked to the Providence Call Center, which is 907-212-LUNG, lung happens to be 5864 in terms of the way to contact us. So does that give you a bit of a snapshot in terms of how the program's gone thus far? And we can answer further questions, too. Sure. I did want to say one more thing, too, and that is that for whatever reason, this type of cancer screening, whether it's just a lack of awareness or other factors and variables, doesn't seem to yield a lot of prospects in terms of seeking screening. Other larger metro areas, much larger than Anchorage, for instance, have seen very few patients since launching the program. Providence has two hospitals in the Los Angeles area, and they've been open for screening longer than we have, and yet have seen fewer patients screened than we have here in Alaska. So,
so it seems like for one reason or another, the word is out a little bit better locally about the availability and perhaps understanding the importance of these this type of screening.
Right.
I want to ask Kathleen her experiences, but I think this is the appropriate time to take just a short break and ask Kathleen to hold on just a little bit longer. And so we're going to do our normal halftime break. And I want to remind everybody again, you're listening to Line One. My guests are Kathleen Roderick. She's a patient who's undergone some screening for lung cancer, and we want to hear her experiences. Roy Olpen is in the studio. He is the director of the Providence Cancer Center. And James Blom is a radiation oncologist joining us by telephone. We're discussing the evidence for published guidelines for screening for lung cancer in certain patients and how effective the screening is and who should be screened. You can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number is 550-8433. After the short break, we'll continue our conversation. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're discussing the rationale for screening for lung cancer in certain patients, and my guests are Kathleen Roderick, who we're going to hear from in just a minute, who's a patient who has gone through some lung cancer screening, Roy Olpen, the director of the Providence Cancer Center, and online and not in the studio is Dr. Jamie Blom, who is a radiation oncologist. You can listen to this program at any time by going to alaskapublic.org and finding our local website there, our link. And we also have on that link a number of other links that will get you to important information about lung cancer if you would like to know more. Also, you can call us at 550-8433 during the next 30 minutes or so. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email again at line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Kathleen, how did you hear about the program? What were your thoughts? How did you make the decision? What's been your experience?
Well, I received the postcard in the mail, and I read it. I looked at it, put it down, and I didn't throw it in the junk mail. And I looked at it several times over probably a couple of weeks. And then I decided, you know, I've got to do this because I want to know. I've smoked for a long time, and I've been quit for 3 years now.
And so I
just felt that it would give me a little bit of peace of mind to know, or at least knew what I had to deal with.
How long had you been smoking?
since I was a teenager.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So you met the criteria that we've discussed so far.
I did.
Age and the number of years of smoking.
Yes, I did.
All right. And it
gets your attention when someone says, well, maybe we can see if you have any greater risk than you might think you do.
Well, yes.
You weren't having any symptoms.
No, none. Mm-hmm. But it's always there, and I've always read that, you know, lung cancer especially is something that you cannot detect. There's no symptoms.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why the prognosis is so poor, mm-hmm. is it's so delayed when it becomes to people's attention, if
exactly.
I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's why I made the decision mm-hmm. to go ahead and get the screening. Mm-hmm. And I will continue to get the screening because I feel that it's something that it will at least keep me aware of what's going on with my body. And I know that I abused it for many years, and now I'm trying to really take good care of myself.
Okay, so what'd you do then? You called some phone number?
I did. I called this phone number, and they took a message.
Yeah.
Everybody takes a message. And then I got called back, mm-hmm. And then they went over the criteria and felt that I would be a reasonable candidate for the program. And so they told me that then they would have it evaluated, and then they would call me back. And so then I received a call scheduling me for my CT scan. Mm-hmm. And so I went in, I had that. It took about 15 minutes and I totally painless. I mean, you know, it was very unobtrusive and intrusive. And so, you know, it was nothing.
Okay.
and then I talked with Dr. Blum about the results.
Mm-hmm. Good. Good. Was there some discussion before you said they called you and talked to you and made sure you were a candidate based on the information that we have?
That's correct. Yes, yeah. It was quite, not a lengthy interview, but it was mm-hmm. thorough.
Mm-hmm.
It was thorough.
Okay. So, any surprises?
Yes. I was listening to the statistics on people that have responded to this, and I am very surprised.
By?
The fact that the more people are not, because I know my generation, mm-hmm. boy, we were all smokers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I know that there's more than 12 people of my fellow
right.
classmates that are out there that probably
right.
should have this done.
Right.
And so I was surprised at the response. And I would encourage anyone, just for your peace of mind, to go in and have it done.
Dr. Blum, the thing we haven't talked about specifically so far as the screening is it's done by a CT scan, and it's more than just a CT scan. So would you tell us about CAT scan technology?
Sure. And actually, I want to make one other point first. As I find myself doing sometimes, you had referred to Kathleen as a patient undergoing screening. It's important to keep in mind that these are not patients. These people have nothing wrong with them. And so our burden to do no harm is even higher.
Good point.
So when we look at performing an intervention, and, you know, no matter how painless the scan may be, it's an intervention that could have other consequences down the road. You know, we in radiation, we follow what's called the ALARA principle, as low as reasonably allowable. Okay, we would prefer people have no radiation exposure compared to a little. So when we do any intervention, we want to make sure that it's as little radiation as possible. You've heard us say that these are low-dose CT scans. So to put that in perspective, this is roughly a quarter the dose, the radiation exposure that you would get with a regular diagnostic CT scan. Okay, so significantly lower amount of radiation with this versus a regular CT scan. It's equivalent of maybe about 10 chest x-rays. Okay? So the risk of forming a problem or forming a cancer because of the radiation delivered by this screening is extraordinarily small. And that's the most important first point. The second point is that you have to have a good algorithm to follow to deal with the results. You know, it used to be the algorithm was if there was a nodule in the lung, you went to surgery, it came out. Well, we now know from these lung cancer screening trials that with a good algorithm in place, that the potential for intervention is much, much less. So about 7% of people in the lung cancer screening trial, only about 7% of people who had an abnormal scan actually wound up getting an intervention, meaning a biopsy, a bronchoscopy, a surgery. Okay, so in very carefully following these rules. So in other words, if you come up with a small nodule that's less than 6 millimeters, what do you do? Well, you just continue your scan in another year. If it's between 6 and 8 millimeters, you get a scan in 3 months. If it's greater than 8 millimeters, then you go ahead and you look at maybe a PET scan, et cetera. But you don't just go leap into an interventional procedure on these folks.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps it's worth also mentioning the background radiation risk. You mentioned that these CT scans, the technology has gotten to where at least the screening for this is about the same as 10 chest x-rays. I think it's worthwhile reminding patients that we're all getting exposed to ionizing radiation all the time, and that in particular, once you take that flight on to Seattle and you get up at 40,000 square feet, your risk is, I think, you may want to correct me, something like approaching that of a chest x-ray anyway.
Yeah, a little bit less than that, but
okay.
You know, the unit of measure is called a millisievert.
Okay.
That's the unit of measure for exposure to radiation in tissue. A diagnostic CT scan is about 8 millisieverts. These low-dose CTs are about 1.8 millisieverts, and just by living on planet Earth, walking around, you get somewhere between 2 and 3 millisieverts a year just because.
Okay. All right. So we've established that there's quite a bit of benefit. This lung cancers as a group are diagnosed late because they're relatively quiet. Chest x-rays aren't that effective. If we've now identified a group of people that are at high risk, and the evidence is good that if we find them early, that the survival rate improves. Kind of being careful about choosing my words because this
sure.
gets important. So what are some negatives? This seems like a slam dunk, but we're not screening everybody because not everybody has the same risk. So there's got to be some risk factors associated with doing these screens.
Sure. Well, I think the biggest impediment right now is cost. You know, Medicare, Medicaid has not picked this up initially. There are not private insurers that cover for the initial screen. Now, that being said, we've worked with the radiologists here at Providence who have been very, very good, and they will do the low-dose CT procedure and the interpretation of the study, so reading it, for a flat fee of, I think it's $425. Okay, I think that's been the number one impediment because people will call, they'll get screened, and we'll say, you know, we can do a CT scan for your screening, but it's going to cost you $425, and they say no, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kathleen can kind of comment on whether makes that a value or not, but I think that's the number one impediment. Now, people who actually do have Blue Cross Blue Shield, if there's something abnormal found on the scan, then, of course, their insurance, I believe, you know, kicks in at that point.
Okay. Other risks as we decide why we should be doing it and why maybe we don't want to do it?
Well, on a societal basis, the question overall is cost, whether this is a cost-effective use of dollars. And you know, again, I think when you look at the cost for, well, let me back up one second. When we look at the benefit of screening for lung cancer is equivalent to the benefit of doing mammography in women. The difference is we can better identify those people at a higher risk mm-hmm. of getting cancer than we mm-hmm. can lung cancer than we can higher risk of getting breast cancer. So that's number one. You can identify your population. Number two, we know that we have a relatively low-risk intervention for this. So the scans give you good information, not only lung cancer, but when you look outside of lung cancer and you look at other processes that were found at time of lung of the low-dose CT screening, there was about a 7% survival advantage between the cohort that had CT and chest X-ray. Why? Because you were finding people who had things that weren't lung cancer. They had renal cell carcinoma, so kidney cancers that you saw on the bottom of your scan. They had a lymphoma. They had they had aortic dissections. They had other benign processes that might be life-threatening. So you're getting more information than just lung cancer. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, you know, as Kathleen will commented, we make everybody come in to see us to go over their results if they're ordered through the lung line. So in other words, if a primary care doctor orders your scans, then you follow up with your primary care doctor. But if somebody calls that 212-LUNG and gets a scan, then I have them come in to see me. And I don't charge them for that. That's free. Mm-hmm. But I think it's an excellent opportunity to make sure that if someone is currently a smoker, that you talk to them about smoking cessation and you give them the resources available for that. You make sure that if it's a woman that they are up to date on their pap smears and their mammograms and their colonoscopies. If it's a man that they're up to date on their colonoscopies and their PSAs. So it's another opportunity to sort of piggyback on lung cancer screening to make sure that they are plugged in medically otherwise. Make sure they have a primary care doctor. There have been probably about a third of the people that I've seen that had no primary care physician, and so we'll call in and get them plugged in with somebody. So I think that the actual benefit gets magnified when you look at the other potential ramifications of other aspects of their health care that you're influencing.
Let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA 91.1 here in Anchorage. If you've got questions or comments about screening for lung cancer, this is the time to give us a call. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We'll also be here for another 15 minutes or so answering emails at line1@alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. If you go to alaskapublic.org and look for the link to the Line 1 program, you can also listen to this program at any time after the program. And we also have an archive of prior programs. Dr. Blum, one of the arguments against prostate screening and in certain age groups with mammography is that the risks of screening, finding other problems that lead to interventions that by themselves have a greater risk than the potential for cancer has been a concern. And so I wanted to address that. Is how many false positives are we finding? How are those addressed? False positives being those that look like they might be something bothersome and end up later not be. And so that's a big issue on the potential negative side. How do we talk about that? What do we know about that in this particular screening?
Absolutely. So the false positive rate, so in other words, the chances of having a CAT scan that shows, quote, an abnormality that turns out not to be an abnormality is very, very high. It's like 95-ish%, 94%, okay? That doesn't mean that 94-95% of people are going to wind up having some intervention done because of that. What that means is that those 95% have something seen on the CAT scan. Most of those abnormalities are going to be these small things that you're going to follow. So you'll repeat your CAT scan in 3 months, or you repeat your CAT scan in 6 months, or repeat your CAT scan in a year. And it's the risk of having an intervention, as I said, is only 7%. Okay. So the risk of having something invasive done, like a biopsy, mm-hmm. was really pretty darn low, about 7%. So true, the false negative rate is high, and frankly, you kind of want it high because you don't want to be missing people. Where you have to be careful is that you have a good algorithm that you're following to know what to do with those. Mm-hmm. So what happens with those in a well-established, formalized lung cancer screening program is that those people get triaged into their appropriate follow-up regimen. So in other words, it's going to be a very small percentage of those that are actually going to come to a biopsy or something invasive, something where actual more physical harm can occur. That doesn't mean that's all the harm. You know, there's also the psychological effects of gee, they found a 5-millimeter lesion, and they said come back in a year to get a CAT scan. I'm not minimizing that. But as far as physical risk interventions, those numbers are pretty darn small.
Okay, that's good to hear. Valerie, you're on line one. What can we answer for you?
Yes, I was just curious if the CT method is better than just giving a blood test, like a CA-125 blood test.
Yeah, Dr. Baum, do you know what the CA-125 is all about?
Yeah, sure. The CA-125 is a marker that's typically used for ovarian cancer. It's not exclusive to ovarian cancer, but is used predominantly in that setting. There really is no blood test that is a good screen for lung cancer. You know, the CA-125 and PSA are relatively unique because those are really the two best markers we have, blood markers we have for cancers, and the CA-125 being for ovarian and PSA, of course, being for prostate cancer.
Hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so the answer is no. The best screen we have right now is the CT scan. All right, thanks for your call. Kathleen, when you went in to have your CT scan, what were your concerns? Did you have some issues that we haven't addressed yet, or like finding something you didn't want to have found or know about or anything like that?
No, not really, because I had done my homework and I had researched this before I made my decision.
Okay.
And so I knew exactly what was, and that there would be the possibility of other things showing up on the CT scan. And so I was fully aware of that when I went in.
Okay. And you implied in how you answered one of the questions earlier that you may be going to have to, or you are going to, screen again at some point.
Yes, it was recommended that I have another screening in a year.
Okay. Nothing was found?
Nothing was found. Everything was fine. Mm-hmm. And but just as a precaution, and I totally agreed with that.
All right.
Well, Thad, if I may comment there, part of the whole process is annual screening for at least 3 years.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that, so good.
And what you might find interesting is that from year one to year two, they found as many, quote, abnormalities, and then slightly fewer from year two to year three. So just because you have a CAT scan, now, doesn't mean that next year you don't need to do it, because you are just as likely next year to have that abnormality as you were this year.
Why is that? Help listeners understand that.
Well, you know, every imaging modality has a sensitivity,
right.
So
a
resolution,
right.
And so some things are just too small. They may be there this year, but it's just too small to actually see. And so when you do the imaging next year, it grows just that little bit more, and you can say, "Ha! Now I can see it."
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that people, you know, and again, when I see them in clinic to go over their results, I emphasize two things to them. One, that just because you had a negative scan now, that does not give you permission to continue smoking. That means that you have dodged a bullet so far, but if you're smoking, you really need to work on stopping smoking, and if you stop smoking, you sure as heck shouldn't restart. And then the second thing is that, yeah, next year's scan is just as important as this year's scan. You've basically set upon a several-year course here of really trying to, protect yourself from lung cancer as best you can, and it's a multi-year time investment.
The other thing that I understand it, the CT scan, the CAT scan technology is a series of slices through the lung at different depths. So it's not, there's differences. And I'm guessing that in this low-dose CT technology, there are broader strips. They're not fine strips. Therefore, you limit the number of X-ray exposure. And then that also will perhaps increase the likelihood of false negatives. So you're trading off some X-ray exposure to a little bit of risk of missing something. Is that true?
I think that's probably pretty well stated. You know, the radiologists that are reading these low-dose CT scans, let me back up a second. Part of forming this program was to get a few dedicated radiologists to read the scans. So, you know, there are probably a dozen or more radiologists here at Providence. Not all of them read these low-dose CT scans because you have to develop a certain acumen in interpreting them. The pictures are not nearly as good as you get with a diagnostic CT.
Okay.
And so you want to concentrate that expertise in reading these in just a few radiologists. And so that's a really important part. But you're correct. This is the pictures are clearly not as pretty as with a diagnostic CT.
Kathleen, how'd you stop smoking?
I just decided one day that I was going to quit.
Didn't do anything special.
I'd wore the patch for a while.
Yep.
But I kept a pack of cigarettes in my kitchen drawer because I wasn't going to go out in the middle of the night if I really wanted one, and I never smoked one since.
Mm-hmm. So I'm hearing you say, you tell me if I'm wrong, you just decided it was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. My father had passed away 3.5 years ago, and his wish had always been that I'd quit smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And
both of my parents smoked quite a bit. When my dad got bladder cancer, as I was talking about, my mother stopped immediately.
Did she?
Both of them stopped immediately. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is there's lots of efforts out there trying to get us to change habits. It gets down to deciding.
I tried
quite seriously that this is the time to do it. And weight loss is no different. I have struggled with that.
We all do.
It's just sooner or later you realize this is the right thing to do for a very.
And I had tried many, many times over the years to quit, but my mind wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And finally it was one day. I can't tell you why I chose the day or whatever.
Yeah.
But
It's just getting there that's the hard part. Mm-hmm. I agree. I am. Weight's no difference, the same deal. As we understand the brain now, we still got these circuits. We did this for a long time. It's like we're learning how to ride a bike. I've said on this program a number of times, you're never going to forget how to ride a bike, so you got to be careful about it.
Oh, I totally agree.
You don't have the cigarettes in the house anymore?
Nope.
Good
I finally threw them out.
Good for you. All right, a couple more minutes here. There's a call here about radon. I'm not sure we can answer it. It's a reasonable question, though. And it says the writer of the email says, please talk about the environmental causes of lung cancer and give some information on radon and houses, the levels that may cause cancer. I know that the EPA sets a limit that is much less than the Canadian government does, saying we're more strict in the United States. What should a person do if they have radon in the house at a slightly higher level than EPA recommendations, for example? So anybody here know how to answer the radon question? Because I don't know specifically.
I have a little bit there.
Okay.
There are abatement programs. If you live in a high radon area, and I do not believe Anchorage is one, but when I lived in Tennessee, East Tennessee, our house had significantly high radon levels in the basement, and there are things that are as simple as ventilating. You know, we had a crawl space underneath the house, and radon comes up through the soil, and it would seep up into the home. And the resolution was as simple as having a couple fans in the crawl space that would just ventilate it out of the crawl space. Beyond that, you've tapped my expertise on abatement of radon.
Yeah, I think I'd go to the EPA or somebody if you really need to answer that question. And I wish we could help you more. One last question, Gail. You're on line one. We got about a couple of minutes left. What can we do for you?
Yes. Suppose someone needed qualified for this test, and they also wanted to have a I don't know if it's a heart scan or just to get a base level of their cholesterol, not cholesterol, but the buildup.
The CT scan of the
heart.
Right,
CT scan. And something to do with a mammogram. Would you be able to do that all at one time and then save on your radiation dosage?
Okay.
No, those are all different procedures. I confess my ignorance on the CT for coronary artery disease. It's certainly not the same technique as this for lung cancer. The mammogram, you know, you'd have to have ordered. You ought to be having ordered by your primary care doctor or your OBGYN. And if there was, I think there probably are criteria for a coronary CT scan as well. So I think those would be great questions to ask your family doc about those other two.
Yeah, but it does raise the question of the additive effect of all these screening tests, which we haven't addressed, and I don't know the answer to either, is we are using more and more of the CT technology as screens, and that's something that has to be taken into consideration at some point, I guess.
Well, you know, there actually are data from people who, would have go to these sort of high-dollar boutiques where people would get, they just go get total body CT scans once a year because they had the money they wanted to. Well, the data show that those people actually have a higher incidence of having a malignancy, and it may be due to their over-aggressive screening.
Right.
With too much radiation dose per screen.
Okay. Well, we got about 30 seconds. Roy? You want to promote your program a little bit more, and then we'll because it's a useful thing. I want to make people aware of it for sure.
Yeah, thank you. We're pleased and privileged to be on the program today. And at Providence, as you had alluded to earlier, Dr. Woodard, we believe we have the only program in the state of Alaska that is designed to enable our population to have lung cancer screening. We're proud of the fact that we're able to launch it, and I think hopefully the audience will have heard a reasonable articulation of the costs and benefits and potential added benefit of being screened if you fit the criteria. And Providence is a mission-based organization here to serve the community, so we appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today and are happy to serve anybody in the future with this kind of an interest.
212-LUNG is the number to call if you're interested in getting more information. 212-LUNG. My thanks today to Catherine Roderick, Roy Alpin, and Dr. James Blum. Thanks very much for doing this for us.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Next week, Peter Osterbauer of the Alaska Neurology Center and a sleep specialist will be joining us, and we'll be addressing your questions about sleep. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, July 22nd. Pat Yak is Chief Contact Officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor. Dave Waldron helped us today as an engineer. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.